M Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour three, and we're exactly 15 minutes into hour three, so we got 45 minutes to spend with you, and that'll include a visit with Michael McCarthy in just a few minutes before we wrap up. But Rich Migliori, who I tried to grab yesterday, and who was at the dentist? Steve Anderson was at the dentist. Rich had something else that was tying him up, but perfect that we get to slip him in with no Andy. Andy's vacationing, which means I think we'll probably see him up here this week, and that means a little bit of a shuffling of the Fox America's Day at the Races deck, and I see some LaDuca. There was a LaDuca spotting over the weekend. Rich Migliori, good morning.
Good morning. You caught me at a perfect time. I just finished mucking my last stall, and I was heading up to the house to get some lunch. So it's like absolutely couldn't have been better timing. And Andy takes vacations? Really?
Andy, you know, when you are working 7 days a week and you're handicapping every card 7 minutes after they're drawn and watching every replay, yes, you got
it. He absolutely does.
You have no idea.
I just like the idea of him in vacation because of the amount of work he does. He just seems like he never stops.
Exactly, and probably a good juncture. We've got a little bit of not a lull, but we got the state bred card coming. Right? Is that this weekend or is it next weekend?
I don't know.
I'm going to pull it up. Hold on, I'll tell you right away.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Here it is. I think it's this week. It is. It's the 24th. The Empire Classic, the Distaff, the Hudson, the Iroquois, the Maid of the Mist, the Mohawk, Sleepy Hollow, Ticonderoga. How many of those, what's the over-under on how many of those in your career you won?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I know I won the Classic, the Sleepy Hollow, the Ticonderoga at least once, the Hudson. I honestly, you got me. I think I had to be, I don't know. I mean, I always love that day. I mean, I love those breeders' days, like Maryland Million, New York Showcase, because you see the people that, you know, breed these horses and the pride and how everybody comes out. And to me, that's kind of the core of racing. You know, where people decided to breed this stallion with this mare and raise the foal. And you've bred horses. You understand that, you know, it's great to win races with any kind of horse, but imagine one that you had to go through the thought process of figuring out the mating and then raising that foal, maybe even being there when that foal was born. I mean, I think that's, to me, melt it all down, and that's the greatest part of this game.
Well, yeah, we certainly enjoy it. You know, you pull up cards and you look at any day, any weekend, and you know, one thing that the pandemic scenario has really, I think, shown is that if you go and look, you find places that and sequences of races, or you know, you watch races, you see things that you know are terrific, and you know, whether they're personal stories, whether they're, you know, heroics of horses and riders, and you know, in fact, I'll give you an example. Nick Gonzalez earlier today, up in Toronto, and you know, what, 10 days removed from the passing of his wife Martha, who you know ran the business together, and wins that Near Arctic on Sunday, and you know, everybody's a dish rag by the time the horse came back.
Sure. Absolutely, yeah.
Barry Abrams and what's going to go on here with Mo Forza. I mean, it just, you know, it's a personal, there's personal, and there's, you know, the other day, I'll give you a funny obscurity. I don't know if you know, the name, Ed Seltzer, and Bev Anderson.
Sure.
Well, the other day I'm watching, and it just so happened to caught my attention that Ed and Bev had a horse in that was coming back at Keeneland, and then hours later were running in Indiana, and two homebreds, and they win, you know, and they win within, I don't know, 3 hours of each other. And I haven't talked to Ed Seltzer in a while, but I had to send him a text, and he said, you have no idea how, he said, I can't remember the last time we won, you know, two races in one day. And he said, we're opening a bottle of wine. And I said, you deserve it. I mean, he's been breeding horses for, you know, decades. And, you know, you take satisfaction in so many different places around the sport.
Well, absolutely. And, I was privileged to see kind of the evolution of the New York Thoroughbred Breeding Program in New York when I was, you know, really young, working out at Bill George's farm out in Yaphank, Long Island, and riding with the mares in the van to go to Nehawk's Bullet and Nehawk's Brother. Those were two of the stallions standing in New York. We had a mare go to Pontoise, which was like a big deal because Pontoise had set like a track record at Turf Paradise, or maybe even American record at the time for 6 furlongs. And back then, you knew, like, you could pick out most of the New York breds. They looked like New York breds. And then I went to work for Steve DeMauro, and he was very influential with the New York Thoroughbred Breeding Program. And being at his farm in Milneck, and, you know, he'd be dropping foals there, and actually my first $100,000 stake winner was born there, Sipiter's Hope, by Sipiter. And the mother passed away right after childbirth, and Stephen and everybody having a bottle feed a Sipiter's Hope until they could get a nurse mare, because it wasn't as prevalent, like, to just be able to run out and get a nurse mare. We weren't in the bluegrass, you know. And then 3 years later, as a three-year-old, and I'm a 16-year-old apprentice jockey, I win actually back then it was the DeWitt Clinton, it's now the Albany, and it was $100,000. And he beat a horse of Dr. DeLuke's Adirondack Home. And Dr. DeLuke used to win all those races with Vandy Sue and those kind of horses, Dedicated Ruler. And we won and paid like $51. And, you know, Steven's crying in the winner's circle, Mr. DeMauro, Mrs. DeMauro. We were all, because of the history and what went into getting there. And then, obviously, and the New York breds kept getting better and riding horses like Wynn, the first $1 million New York bred to earn $1 million. Paul Kornman owned him. Sally Bailey trained him. Four Star Dave, and then, you know, so on and so forth. Grooming horses for Chester Broman's kids at the Knoll Farm. I was a show groom. I was like 12 years old, and I would be at my grandfather's house for the summer, and I'd work there grooming horses. You'd get $40 a week, Steve, grooming eight, and Mr. Broman would come in and give you $20. And I didn't remember him in particular, but Bart Antispen was his first racehorse, and he's in John Kimmel's barn, which was Steve DeMauro's barn, by the way. And he says, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I'm saying, "No, sir, I'm sorry." He says, "Knoll Farm in Brentwood, Long Island, you groomed my kids' horses." Oh, my God, that was the guy that used to give you half your paycheck as a tip. I mean, you know, and then winning a Florida Derby on a New York bred Friends League for him. So it's remarkable, the intersections and the spider web that's cast, the net that's cast in our game, and all the connections. You know, the thing with the Kevin Bacon, 6 degrees of separation. I think in the game we're all like 6 degrees of separation, right? We're all like connected somehow.
No doubt, and I'm going to throw a few of these at you now because you went down this road, so now you're obligated. You've actually, you won both versions of what is now the Empire Classic. Certain people will be old enough to remember when it was the Empire Stakes for two-year-olds. Do you remember the two-year-old you won on?
BC Sal,
yeah.
And if I ever forget that one, I'm in big trouble, because I got engaged that evening.
Oh, how fun.
Yep. We were walking down to Eartha's Kitchen, used to be down Filer Street across from, like,
yes. Ben and Jerry's. Yes.
And I had a whole, like, plan, and we're walking down, and we walked in front of Lyrical Ballad, and I got the ring in my pocket. You know, I'm 20 years old, and I just forget the whole plan, went out the window with the romantic dinner and everything, and just in front of Lyrical Ballad, I was like, you want to do this? You know? but I had won the stake on BC Sal that day.
How fun. And that was tomorrow. You also, of course, won on Gander when it was the classic.
Man, Gander was so good that day. The thing about Gander was he just needed to be outside. He really disliked running inside of horses. And he broke towards the inside of the day, Steve, and I let him run away from the chute, and they were going fast. I got outfooted by three or four horses, and I literally just found a gap and angled him to about the sixth path. He made this big middle move, but that's the way he needed to run. Like, if I had gotten caught up down in there, he probably wouldn't have won, but he was good enough to be able to use him like that and make that long run. John Terranova, his wife Tanya, they did an amazing job. He was so ready that day.
How funny! Now I'm gonna throw one that you want to talk some sadness. Lately there's been so much sadness, but I'm gonna bring up your Hudson winner. Wire Me Collect.
K Mac. Yeah, what a nice man. He, you know, had become his go-to rider when he would chip into New York. I wrote Stormy Atlantic for him, American Champ. Wire Me Collect. I mean, any time he was KG Exuberance, really nice man. What a classy man that was. And Wire Me Collect was good at that. I think he ran like 8-4, if I'm not mistaken.
And that's not a name. I don't remember that. I don't remember the name.
Yeah, no, but he was good. But Mr. K Mac, what a nice man. Just what a tragedy that was. I mean, but The Ticonderoga was, I think I won it once for Leo O'Brien and once for Command.
Well, and I hadn't gotten to the Ticonderoga yet, but that's all right. You won it back to back for Leo. That was in 97 and 98. Irish Daisy and then Terravine.
Yeah, Terravine was real nice. Belonged to me, Philly. And she usually was on the lead. I think that day she might have come from just off the pace. And Irish Daisy, it's funny because I was at, in Pauling at Akindale, the horse rescue, and I was going around looking at horses and visiting. And she was pensioned there. This is going back 5 or 6 years ago now. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's Irish Daisy. I used to ride her. And they actually pulled her halter off and gave it to me. Her halter's in my tack room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty neat, really nice, you know.
I love that. It's very cool. Well, we got three more. You won the Mohawk, and this is not a name I know or remember. The horse was It's Windy for Liz Zemp.
Yeah. I think it's the only time I rode that horse. Real flighty, real, like, kind of a nutty horse. If I'm remembering correctly, yeah.
And you won Friends Lake. You won the Sleepy Hollow on Friends Lake, of course. And then one more, the Iroquois, Carly's Command.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Carly's Command. That was Gaspar Moshera.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think I'm like a crazy Bob that day. Like, I didn't think I won, and she had her nose down. You know, real quick, I'll tell you a funny story with Friends Lake. So, as a 2-year-old, he was like, I said this the other day on the show, people laughed. You know, like, you used to see those old Jack Lane commercials where, you know, big muscular guy would kick sand on the smaller, punier guys on the beach, right?
Yeah.
And that was Friends Lake as a 2-year-old. And I was bottled up leaving the 3/8 pole, and literally I put my shoulder on one horse and I pushed three of them out of the way. Like not bumped them out of the way, just literally like muscled them out, you know, nicely, and then he galloped. So Dennis Bryder was head of the New York Thoroughbred Breeders at the time, and I worked for Dennis since I was a little kid out on Long Island with horses in the farm, and he was presenting the trophy, and I said to him, I said, this is a real horse. I said, he's better than just a good New York bred. serious horses. He's like a man amongst boys. I said, man, this guy, he keeps on developing the way he is. He's a Kentucky Derby kind of horse, right? So after that, he got a break. I go to Florida, ride him in the Holy Bull, and he acted terrible, tore up the starting gate, tore up the paddock. He, like, lost his mind. And Steve, he hadn't grown an inch, hadn't changed at all. He didn't get broader. He was as good as he was at two. He never changed. He was exactly the same horse. And everybody else had caught up. Like the kid that you know, his voice changed and he's got a shave going into high school. But then by, you know, they get to college, everybody else is caught up, right? So he got beat 10 lengths, and I was like, yeah, man, I don't want to go ride him again. He didn't develop. He didn't make the jump from two to three, and he was nuts. And John Kimmel was after me to come and ride him. And I'm leading rider in New York that winter, and I could ride, you know, four or five favorites, probably the favorite in the stake. Do I really want to go? So I had been putting John off, you know, just kind of, oh, let me know, you know, the jockey speak. And I went up to Saratoga to visit with Dennis and went to his office, New York Thoroughbred Breeder's office. We were going to go get lunch. And he said to me, are you going to go ride Friends Lake? It was snowing out. It was like February. Are you going to go ride Friends Lake? And I was like, yeah, I don't think so. I said, I can ride a bunch of nice horses in New York that day. I wasn't happy with him, you know, in the Holy Bull. And Dennis quoted back to me what I said to him about him as a two-year-old. And he goes, listen, you don't throw a horse off out of for one bad race, and blah, blah, blah. So I picked up the phone in his office, and I called John. And I said, John, how's the horse doing? And he said, he worked really well this morning. We took him up to Gulfstream, worked him here. We've been schooling him here. He's acting much better. He's doing good. Okay, I'll come ride him. So I think it was like March 14th. I fly down there to ride him, my birthday. And Dennis had some kind of breeders conference down there. So we meet at the Diplomat. I'm staying at the Diplomat. We have dinner, and I'm handicapping the race, Steve. I'm going, he ain't good enough. This horse can't. I don't see how he can win. And I start, well, listen, if I ride him perfect, I could be third. That's $100,000 to the Bromans. I'll make $10,000. It's a payday, you know. And I went in with the idea of just trying to ride him perfect to get a check. And we broke. He broke sharp. He acted much better. John did a great job schooling him. Was down the fence, maybe 10 lengths off the lead. And I'm watching down the backstretch. Johnny Velasquez had barely pinned in. The horse in the lead drifted, barely not one to be a victim. He went up inside that horse. So Johnny goes after him. The race starts heating up. Tappet goes after them. It was as I'm watching, I'm like, this is great. This is great because they're all chewing on each other, and the race really picked up a lot in the middle. And by the 3/8 pole, I said, I'm going to get a piece of this, you know. And then the quarter pole, I'm definitely going to be third. At the 8th pole, I'm definitely going to be second. At the 16th pole, I'm going to be a mad SOB if I don't get there. And he got up and won and paid $76.
I remember the price. I remember that he was a big price that day.
Yes, and as it turns out, that was the first race that I ever won worth $1 million. It was on a horse for a man I used to groom his kids' horses at the Knoll Farm in Brentwood, Long Island, for a trainer that was very, you know, instrumental in, you know, my career, putting me on a lot of winners. And, you know, it was a big deal. It was a really big deal.
Well, those of you that took the over was 7.5. So eight New York Fall Showcase wins for Meg. In his career. 1, 2, make sure that's right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 is correct. There we go. And a story goes with it, as Damon Runyon wrote. Got to ask, there's a few things to do here. And that includes yesterday. I had Matt Hegarty this morning to start the show, Rich, about the whip rule situation and yesterday's New York Gaming Commission meeting. I know I've already brought it up with you, Tony, and Mike Smith were together Thursday on the show. This is going to continue to be a hot topic for the foreseeable future. And when you talk to the riders, you know, where do things stand, do you think, in your mind and in their mind?
Well, the sense I get is that, you know, everybody understands that we need to keep evolving and modifying things, and we all want what's best for the horses. I mean, I don't think there's, I shouldn't say absolutes. I think there are very few riders that don't understand that horses have given them a life and given them everything, and are appreciative of that, and genuinely care about the horses. When it comes to, I mean, I love them. You know, I can only speak for myself in that respect. And I just don't like the way the whole thing has come to be. And I go back to this, Steve. I am against change for perception's sake. If you want to make change, make meaningful change that really means something. Not because it looks like the right thing, because it is the right thing. And a lot of what I hear is about, well, for the public perception and growing a younger fan base. And meanwhile, if you go on social media and you go on message boards, the people that are wagering on these races, which is what drives this engine, are against it. They like, how are we supposed to wager on horses with confidence if we feel like, you know, a rider can't get the best out of them? So to play to an audience that may come out for a big race day or nothing better to do on a Sunday or a Father's Day, and running the risk of alienating your true base, I don't know if that makes a lot of sense from a business standpoint. Now, that's business. Do I think that years ago the whip was overused? 100%. And I see times when it's still overused, and that's when the hammer of Thor needs to come down on riders that don't use it as a tool, but, you know, becomes a punishment. It's supposed to be an aid, not a punishment. And it's clear cut to me when it goes over that line. And that's when the punishments for riders, the repercussions of that have to be meaningful and harsh. And guys will learn to adapt to doing it in a way it was meant to do. I don't hear anybody talk about, you know, these rules about you can't hit a horse more than three times in a row. You should never hit a horse, any horse, three times in a row. You should never hit him twice in a row. Because if you look at the mechanics of a horse's stride, a horse does not pull himself. They propel themselves. They push off their hind end. If a horse's hind legs are on the ground and you're asking him to run and you reach back and you swat him with the crop, and at this point it is a crop. It's nothing like the whips, and they wore whips back in the day. They basically, all they do is make noise now. They if anything, it's more of getting a flight response without inflicting pain. But getting back to the mechanics of it, if a horse's hind legs are on the ground, that's when you're supposed to be in the active motion of you know, reaching back and tapping them with it. And they're going to propel themselves forward. When their front feet are on the ground, and that'll be when a horse's rider's arms are extended, right? You know, like you see these great shots when a rider's all stretched out on a horse. Look at the front feet. At least one of the front feet are on the ground. When a horse is recoiled, the rider's face is in the mane and their body's more bunched up. When a horse's front feet, at least one of the front feet are on the ground, you're not supposed to be actively in the motion of reaching back to tap them, because all they do is pick their feet up faster, and in essence, you slow them down. I have not heard one person talk about the mechanics of a horse's stride and the proper way to use a riding crop. And to me, that goes back to education. So when you see a rider go pat, 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 he's hit him off stride at least once and maybe twice. It's about getting in a rhythm. I think more horses run from being shown the stick and basically almost, again, getting in that sink, so you're urging them forward. Again, riders lose, jockeys lose their leg aid because they need to ride with shorter stirrups to be more aerodynamic, but also more to the point so that the weight carried by the horse is carried more efficiently. Do you want to go back to where riders have to ride with longer stirrups? They can't find that sweet spot on a horse's withers. They can't get the balance over that center of gravity. More horses will get injured because of that, because now you're riding with longer stirrups, your legs will be moving, you'll be throwing horses' weight off side to side. I guarantee you'll have more equine injuries if riders have to revert to riding with longer stirrups again. So these are the things that I feel like are being missed in these conversations. We're talking about public perception, and we're not talking about reality and what is best for horses and riders in reality, rooted in reality, in fact, not theory, fact.
And I'm glad you addressed the stirrup length thing, because that's been I've heard that asked. If maybe there could be more control if the stirrups were dropped.
Well, if you want to go riding in the show ring or you want to go out for a tail ride, I recommend you ride with longer stirrups. Absolutely. But if you're going to ride races, first of all, you know how many riders will wind up with broken legs leaving the starting gate?
That's a fair point, too.
Go. When they used to ride with those much longer stirrups, they didn't have starting gates. As it is now, you know how many guys have been injured breaking the side of a gate with your stirrups that long? You guys, broken knees, broken femurs. You know, I love horses. I have horses. I have retired horses here. I just got mucking stalls. I've been up since 5 o'clock in the morning working on my farm. Most of them can't be ridden. I like to look at them. They're beautiful. It gives me a sense of peace. It gives me pleasure. I want nothing from these horses but to feed them, take care of them, look at them, muck their stalls. I love horses. But there also is a human factor in this. And what riders are that, you know, disposable, that, well, it doesn't matter. Yeah, that guy broke his leg. There's another jockey. Come on. We got to use common sense for this. And I don't see a lot. I just don't hear a lot of common sense. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not listening close enough. I don't know. But I do drive about 200 miles a day when I work. And this is the stuff I think about. And honestly, nobody really asked me my opinion but you. So, and my wife. So you're in good company, Steve.
Well, I'm that surprises me a little. I mean, this has not been. I'm surprised. I'm surprised that you didn't weren't a part of the yesterday. The session. Somebody would want to hear from you.
When you have active riders talking about this, I think active riders have to be inhibited. Because you know, it's a little bit like politics, right? If you state how you genuinely feel in one direction or the other, you're alienating somebody else, and you ride for a lot of different people. And I think that having active riders on these conversations, other than getting their opinions, but like at a gaming commission meeting like this, puts them in an awkward and untenable position. That's my opinion. I think that's why you have the guild and you have spokespeople. And certainly, you know, having three Hall of Fame riders on this conversation yesterday, you know, it carries weight. But at the same time, I don't think that they have the opportunity to speak as frankly as maybe they want to about certain things. And, you know, I just know when I rode, there was times you just, I'm just going to be quiet because I'm going to get somebody mad if I say it. I don't have to worry too much about that anymore. But I actually texted with Johnny Velasquez last night, and you kind of laid out some points that I thought were missed and some things that could have been rebutted in a clearer fashion. And again, I don't know the format of what, you know, that took place. Maybe they didn't have the ability to come back with responses to certain things. But the little bit, or more than a little bit, that I listened to, I was kind of frustrated listening. Like, you got to jump in and state certain things in rebuttal to certain things that were being said. And I thought Carmine D'Onofrio, the New York stewards, actually were fairly spot on. You know, we've evolved so much, Steve, and we didn't do it right. You know, when I first started riding, it wasn't right. But if a rider didn't look like he was really getting into a horse, and a rider didn't leave a mark on a horse, which is horrible, but that's what it was 40 years ago. And we've learned, and we've developed, and we keep coming. But now we're getting to a point where now we're bordering on the ridiculous. And to that matter, and this goes back to, I always talk about education, and I really feel as a whole, we haven't done a good enough job educating not just the public, but stakeholders. And I'm not going to bring up the guy's name, but my brother, Michael, works for Dylan Davis, and they got fired from a trainer a few weeks ago. And the trainer told him because he didn't whip the horse enough. That's idiotic. It's moronic. The horse was beaten. I want to see my horses ridden through the wire. We've got to end that culture, 1,000,000%. And a rider also has to know when a horse is giving them everything they have, they don't have to show people that, you see, I'm still trying hard. This horse is giving me his best. You know, when I was a kid, yeah, you know, you get excited. And again, the culture kind of demanded it. As I got older, horse was running for me. I wasn't going to reach for the stick. I was just going to keep hand riding and hold them together, keep them balanced, keep them going forward. That's about educating riders. It's not the jockey that hits the hardest, whips the most, you know, goes crazy with it. If anything, more races are lost that way. But it is an effective tool if used as a tool and used properly. And guys, you know, being taught to use it properly when it's absolutely necessary, not flailing away for a trainer that thinks that that's the way to go. Obviously, it's not a good horseman. You know, when is horsemanship, you know, come into this? We've got to use common sense, horsemanship, you know, intelligence, and make change for because it's the right thing and it does the right thing by the horses
right.
and the humans involved.
Right. No, just brilliantly framed and stated. Really good, Rich. I'm glad we got this in, and it really was a perfect bookend for, you know, the conversation I had with Matt Hegarty to start the show. And also, Steve Anderson touched on it, you know, because it, you know, the situation is evolving differently in each, you know, in each jurisdiction, as this thing gets handled. Before we go, Michael McCarthy is going to join us just for the last 10 minutes. I do want to ask you one performance from, the last, couple of days of racing, performer. How much of a comeback was that for him to, you know, set him up to compete in the Cigar Mile?
Oh, I think it was perfect. You know, you want to have a horse come back, and of course you want them to win, but you don't want to get to the bottom of them. He ran a mile in 1:33.4. Track was fast, but still racehorse time. With something left. I mean, he cruised up inside of those horses. His ears were up. Joel made very little use of him. You know, people want to talk about show a tape to young riders about having confidence in your horse and knowing a horse is doing everything you need him to do. That, to me, was absolutely a beautiful example of it, and I was very impressed. You know, the thing that impressed me about him, he's got this big, long stride and, you know, kind of an imposing type of horse, but he's very light on his feet. And those are your best horses. The ones that are bigger but they move lighter, that's a pretty formidable combination. And yeah, Sid McGay is just amazing. I enjoy watching his work with these horses so much. It's just old school, and his horses even look more like the old time old school race horses, don't they? Like look at, you know, the Munnings paintings and stuff. Pretty impressive.
Well, and, you know, he bookended the weekend with the two 2-year-old wins, that Cafe Society filly on Sunday, and going back to Friday, a horse that I had brought up with him last week, that 10 for 10. And, you know, what's notable about, you know, Shug's babies when they win early, they're not necessarily going to, you know, post you know, monster figs, but really good, strong, solid foundations to advance. He's unbelievable. Really.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't crank one up to win first time. They win first time. It's, you know, he hasn't fit. He hasn't ready. But
exactly.
It's because they're good. He builds on races. He doesn't. It's not all in first time out.
No. No. No, except when he's the 7 furlong, which is something that it was unearthed on the show years and years ago. It was I kind of latched on to this thing where Shug would telegraph if he's got a horse that is going to be a route goer. When he debuts them at 7, it's an indication that they might be good enough to win today, that extra distance, that they're, you know, long-winded. And we've gone to town on that over the years, many, many times. Watch for those 7-furlong Shug debuts.
That's great. I remember when Easy Goer debuted, I was hurt. I wasn't riding. I was in Saratoga, and I went to the harness track, the simulcast, because there was a lot of buzz about him. My friend Sean Connolly, good friends with Andy, too. And we went there, and, you know, we're all going to bet on him, but he's no price. And then Sean says, like, yeah, you got to back wheel him, too, in exactives, because just in case something happens, first thing I started. So we wound up back wheeling him, and a horse named Lorenzoni beat him a nose with John Cruguet. And paid like $17, and the exact came back really good. And we wanted to see something special. Obviously, Easy Goer was special, but it actually worked out financially better for us. He ran second that night.
I love it. Rich, this was great. And one thing I didn't get to do, I found doing some work over the weekend cleaning up, I found a Wood Memorial program from 1987. And
Chocolate One.
Chocolate One is correct.
Yeah, I think he finished third. I think it was Gulch and Gone West.
And Capote was in there, and a serious group.
That was for Frank Robicetta, the Angels. That was
yes.
We used to win a lot of races together, good people.
I love it. And boy, what a list of riders: Randy Romero, Jimmy Edwards, Robbie Davis, you, Ruben Hernandez, Santos.
Santos
on Gulch, yeah. Those familiar silks that are now familiar to a whole new generation, Peter Brandt.
I love it. Memories.
This was great, Rich. Outstanding. We'll talk to you. Talk to you next week.
I look forward to it. See you. Thanks.
Richard Migliori on your Twitter, folks, and right now, MWM Racing. Michael W. McCarthy joins us to close out what's been a fun morning, and it was a fun Sunday night. You know, the East Coast, Michael, we're getting ready to go to bed at 9:15, 9:30. I got the radio show, and I'm waiting for the Twilight Derby. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Nice result for us.
And talk about the development of Smooth Like Straight.
The horse I always thought trained well. He put in a few decent works in Del Mar, summer of Del Mar last year. Summer of, I guess, would be 19. Ran Pacific Classic weekend. Wasn't sure whether to run him on the turf or on the dirt. But his gate work was good enough to warrant running him on the dirt. Turned out to be the wrong move. I'm just glad we were able to find out what he liked. Ran him on the turf next time out. Seemed to relish that. And he's just taking it from strength to strength. I had some queries about him running a mile and an eighth, but it seemed like he got the job done just fine here on Sunday night.
Well, and, you know, you look back at what's been obviously an interrupted season, and you came out in February, brought him back for his 3-year-old debut in the Pasadena, the War Chant win when you came to Churchill, then the interruption. And I guess there's a potential school of thought to say that break may be, you know, may be beneficial here long term.
Yeah, I would say that the interruptions we've had due to the pandemic and a few other things, one of the bright shining spots out of all of this has been that it's kind of helped this horse, given him some spacing in between races and what. Hopefully, all this stuff we put behind us in 2021, we get rid of this year and move forward next year, and everybody is racing with regularity, dining with regularity, and everything else. Hmm. But that's not up to me.
Well, Steve Anderson was with us earlier, Michael, and Hollywood Derby seemingly the logical target.
I think this makes a lot of sense. He's a horse that definitely likes the turf firm. I don't think he got that at Churchill Downs on Derby Day in the American turf. We had a fair bit of rain earlier in the week, probably softened up a turf course that isn't really firm to begin with. so may have muddled his chances that day, came back here, found the kind of turf he likes, and I think we're going to have a better chance of getting a turf course like that at Del Mar than we would Breeders' Cup weekend. But we'll leave all of our options open for the moment and see how he comes out of this.
Well, speaking of the Breeders' Cup, let's take the opportunity to get an update on the phalanx of horses that you seem poised to start. And there's a little bit of a buzz about Rombauer, Michael.
You know, I thought his race in the American Pharoah here was pretty darn good, sneaky good. You know, we were lengths behind the winner coming to the 8th pole. At the 16th pole, we were about a length behind him and kind of stayed there. And you go back and watch the replay, I thought Flavian was getting pretty busy on the winner. There may have been 150 people in the grandstand that day, but you could kind of hear everything. You could hear the horses coming at you. You could hear Flavian really getting aggressive. And Mike had sort of wrapped up. I don't think Mike thought we would make any kind of noise inside the 8th pole, and we kept on kind of wearing him down. Look, horse ran second. I'm not saying he would have won. Maybe he would have been beaten a half length. Maybe he would have been beaten a neck. Maybe he would have been beaten a lip. But horse ran well. It's come out of it well. It's got a couple of nice works here. Distance will not be an issue for him. He's very handy. He's very easy. He's a smart little horse. So we'll take him over there and looking forward to have some fun. As with all of these races and all these horses at this time of year, you just want him to get there as happy and healthy as possible.
Well, let's talk about the fillies and how you're going to handle Speech and CC regarding distaff prospects and filly and mare sprint prospects.
Speech, I thought, was unlucky in the Kentucky Oaks, was the recipient of what I called the Malachi Crunch for all you Happy Days fans out there. That starting gate got pinned between Gamine and what have you, and then going down into the first turn, got nailed again, seemingly kind of throwing this filly off stride, and I kind of out of sorts, really found ourselves in the middle of the racetrack and just really never got the kind of trip we were looking for. She had every excuse to run last in the Oaks, and she kind of battled on and ran fourth and was very proud of her. Kind of just basically shows you a little bit about what she's like. All she wants to do is run. We have set a track record in the Ashland at Keeneland, going a mile and a 16th. What I'm seeing right now is I'm seeing a filly that's no worse for wear. Aaron has mentioned the Breeders' Cup filly or mare sprint. That's on the radar. I think we need to keep at this stage, we need to keep all of our options open, whether it's the distaff or the filly or mare sprint. Both races obviously will be very good, shaping up to be quite a distaff. Unfortunately, no Midnight Bisou this year, but still a race big on quality. That being said, we've got CC, who I sprinted last time out. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should have run her the day before, going a mile and a 16th. I just kind of thought we would get a nice pace to run into in the Derby City Distaff. We certainly got a nice pace to run into, but the only problem was we were up on it instead of four or five lengths out of it.
Right.
Left us with very little starch inside the quarter pole. My inclination with her would be the way she's training right now would be to go to the distaff. I thought she's had a couple excuses in two of her last three races. I have a tremendous amount of faith in this mare. I'm going to go with it, go with my gut, and go ahead and, you know, aim towards the distaff.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Michael, we're going to get tight here on time. It's coming up on 9 a.m., but Rushy is well for the dirt mile. Yes?
Well for the dirt mile. I thought his race at Keeneland in the bluegrass was better than it looked. Stuck out in no man's land around the first turn. and basically, you know, put in a wonderful move from the half mile pole to basically midway around the turn, 5/16 pole, and kind of flattened out through the lane. Never got back to his right lead until late, coming approaching the wire. But that race to me is better than it looked, and I think you saw that when he came back and won the Pat Day Mile. I think with a little bit better trip, obviously shortening up a mile, which I don't think is going to make a difference to him, because I think he can go anywhere from a mile to maybe in the right setup a mile and a quarter. But I'm very pleased with what I'm seeing here. Horse is showing me everything you'd want in a horse that's going the right way before a big race, especially a race like the Breeders' Cup.
Well, in great shape all around, whether they're coming to Breeders' Cup or not. Michael W. McCarthy, everybody. Michael, well done, and we'll look forward to Cup.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for having me on. Have a great
week. I appreciate it. Outstanding. Ron Bauer, CC Speech, and Rushy, and you got some indication. Speech looks like she'll turn back, and CC looks like she'll stretch out. So there you go. We love it. Michael McCarthy, Rich Migliori, Steve Anderson, Nick Gonzalez, Gail Cox, Matt Hegarty. That was a lot of show. And we're past the top of the hour. But those of you that are listening on the stream, you get to listen. Good luck today if you're playing. And we will back with you tomorrow. And got a full agenda tomorrow, too. Marcus Hirsch and Sid Fernando and much, much more. Good luck today, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the Races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.